This is the Medicast, July 27th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. This is episode 177 of the Medicast, and it's exciting to be here with everybody. We are going to be getting into a lot of great stuff in this week's episode, and I'll be moving on into that soon. But I want to remind all of you, especially all of you brand new listeners that are checking in on the show for the very first time, that you can find links to everything we talk about in this show over at Medicast.com/blog. The Medicast.com site is our main site for all of our programs. If you go to the Medicast blog, Medicast.com/blog, you'll find our Medicast blog, and in the EMT podcast category there, you will be able to find all of the show notes for all 177 plus episodes, because I don't count all the Medicast LiveX episodes in there. So you can find all the links to all the things, all the tips, all the news items, everything we talk about there. And it's a great way for you to follow up on the information here. So make sure you head over and check out that, plus all the articles and other information posted over at medicast.com. It's great to hear from all of you. Also, don't forget you can get in touch with me here by sending in an email to podmedic@mac.com or calling in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. Get you in here to the voicemail line. And, you know, it's been a while since we've had anybody call in the voicemail line, so let's get some calls in there and check in with me and let me know how things are going in your neck of the woods. Also, don't forget the Medicast forums is a great way for you to keep in touch with what's going on here at the Medicast. Forums.medicast.com. I haven't talked about it recently, but it's still out there and still plugging along. And our good friend Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast is going to be contributing some things on preparedness issues there as well. And I'm excited to hear about Rick's inclusion of some of his materials over there. So you'll want to follow up. It's free to sign up and get logged in over there. You can share videos and photos and a lot of other things over at forums.medicast.com. I heard in from listener David this week as we move into their listener email. David's always checking in with some great ideas and some links, and I always enjoy hearing from David. He's been a listener and supporter of the show for such a long time. And David shared me an article he picked up off of one of the websites with the news items on it, and this particular news item was from Western Australia, which I'm surprised I didn't get something like this from IRC or somebody down there, but a man burst into flames after police officers tried to subdue him with a taser. Now, you know, you wonder how the heck did this happen. Family members claim that it happened, he was set alight after the taser hit him. But, you know, when you read the rest of the story, it's like a no-brainer. Apparently, he had been, he came to the door when the police came to his home, and he had a glass of petrol or gasoline in one hand and a lighter in the other, and he had been sniffing the gasoline for some reason. We had somebody that was in altered mental status, had a highly flammable substance very close by, and somebody introduced a spark. So I guess no wonder he burst into flames. But anyway, David included that link in that article, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes as an extra, but I wanted to just refer back to that. David, thank you very much for sharing that particular news article, and it just goes to show you just never know what you're going to come upon when you roll up on the scene of an incident. It must be David week here at the Medicast, because I got an email in from another listener by the name of David, and he was checking in with kind of an alarming problem, and I really wasn't sure how to approach this, because there were some inconsistencies in his questions, and I think just basically because he's just upset with what's going on. He's a student in EMS. He's working hard to get through his paramedic program. He finished up his classes without any problem and began his clinical internship program portion of the class, and wasn't having any problems, but he seems to be having some kind of a personality conflict with his preceptor, and is really not has not been getting very good reviews from that preceptor, and he believes unfairly. And it's keeping him from advancing further in the class into more clinical time, which is a shame. And I'm not sure of the whole story. There's always two sides to every story, and I'm not saying that David isn't presenting me, you know, a clear picture from his point of view, but I'm sure there are other things going on here. But it does point out that one of the things we have to learn to do in our business is to get along with a lot of different types of people, because we treat a lot of different types of people. But we also have to work with a lot of different types of people, and some of them are going to be more or less committed to patient care than you are, and are more or less committed to doing the job a certain way than you are. And I kind of leave it out there, because sometimes a different way isn't necessarily the wrong way. But some people treat this as just another job, and they go home and they really are, you know, they might as well be flipping burgers. Other people treat this as a true calling. And so, you know, you have to kind of weigh that. It's always alarming to me to hear about a preceptor that has a student that doesn't feel like they're getting a fair shake, because, you know, as a person who's heavily involved in education and doing the things that I do, I try to hold in my mind the belief that every student has an opportunity in some way to get through a given program. If they've met the minimum requirements for that program, and as far as, especially for college degree programs, they've had to get through their math preview classes and pass, you know, some of those other classes to show a minimum level of, you know, brain competency, for lack of a better word. It means that sometimes there's a problem with the educator, and that, you know, it falls to the educator to find the best way to impart knowledge to that student. So that's the way I look at it, but not all educators look at it that way. There's a certain amount of that sink or swim mentality in a lot of medical education environments. Physicians, nurses, you talk to any people in those programs, a lot of them hit their students between the eyes with a sledgehammer on the first semester, in the first units, because they really are trying to weed out the people that don't have what it takes to basically get through a very difficult program. And whether it's paramedic or nurse or physician or anything, there's it's a step up from programs at a similar level in the university system. So, you know, a bachelor's degree in, say, communications and TV production is not as rigorous a program as a person who comes out with a BSN. It's just not the same kind of program. And I think we acknowledge that there's a level of difference between the training that we receive and somebody who might get a similar certificate in another career field. So that said, you know, David, my point would be that most programs have an appeals process. Most people have a lead instructor or somebody who's the preceptor or clinical coordinator, and that's your next step. And if you really feel that they haven't treated you fairly, there's usually somebody above that. But, you know, at some point you're going to run out of the appeals process, and you have to come at it and try to figure out what you're doing wrong. And I want to say that in the right way, because I think that when you walk into a situation, you have to be honest with yourself and say that this is a two-sided street and there are two different viewpoints here. And so I would approach any appeals process as, you know, my grades have been good up to this point. I'm not sure what the problem is, but I would really like an opportunity to achieve this, and I'd like some assistance in doing better. And I think maybe this wasn't the best mix for me as far as a preceptor. And, you know, you're going to run into a lot of different people in the field, and you have to learn to get along with them, but this may not be the best mix for you educationally. And can they find a way to give you another opportunity? That's the way I'd approach it. You know, if you come in there with guns blazing, you know, figuratively, because I don't want anybody going postal, but if you come in there, you know, angry and wanting and demanding, you know, something, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. You attract a lot more flies with honey, right? You know, you're going to get a lot more attention by coming in there and being assertive, but being respectful and admitting that you may be part of the issue. Okay. I hope that helps. And I hope that you have some success with that. And I really want to hear what the next step is for you and how this works out, because you're not the only person having a problem like this. And we'd like to be able to give everybody some good advice. I also heard in from listener Jared. He wanted to know if I had any knowledge of the cost of taking the National Registry Test. He's in an EMS program, but I guess it's a local or state-based EMS program, and it's not a National Registry program, but Jared would like to get his National Registry and wanted to know what the cost of the test was. Someone had told him it was like $2,000 to test for registry. Well, I sent him and replied back, gave him some information on how to find out more, but I will give you the information here. Actually, Jared checked out, followed up on some of the links, and was able to get back in touch with me with the updated information. Anybody who has any questions about national registry testing here in the United States can go to NREMT.org. Okay, NREMT, National Registry EMT.org. NREMT.org is your resource for everything about the National Registry Test. You can get your questions answered. They have a great FAQ section. You can sign up for a registry test online. It tells you exactly how much it is, which it is $110 per attempt. And then you may have to pay to participate in a practical test for National Registry. Although, Jared and others, be aware that some of your local testing, even though the program is not a strictly National Registry program, the practical test environment may be acceptable to National Registry if it has the minimum stations involved. So you can check on that. That may be an option for you, and it will be included already in the program you're taking. But if you need to take National Registry, you would have to go and also find a practical test in some location, and there may be a fee associated with that as well. But the computer-based test that you would go to a test center and take is $110 per attempt. So not $2,000. Good news for everybody. And Jared, thanks for that question, because I know, like I said to David earlier, I think a lot of people have these questions, and it's good that you're sharing them here with me so I can get the answers out to everybody else. Time to jump on into this week's news, and I'll lead off with a story I picked up over at, the Edmonton Sun. This is edmondsun.com, and this is out of Oklahoma, and it's just a story about heat-related illnesses on the rise in that area. And it just reminds me, you know, I talk about this a lot on how do you keep up on your protocols and how do you do different things, but one of the things that you need to do is look at what you expect to see. If it's hot where you are or getting to be hot, you might see more heat-related illnesses. If it's starting to get colder and you're moving into the wintertime, obviously you need to look at cold-related illnesses. If you live near the water, you might want to review your drowning protocols, those kinds of things. And so I just urge you to think about what's going on around you and use that as a way to encourage yourself to get educated on different or re-educated on different topics and things going on. This particular article out of Oklahoma City, just looking at emergency crews recently transported 8 people to local hospitals in one day after soaring temperatures just caused a wave of heat-related illnesses. Another man was found dead after had actually died after being found unconscious at a construction site, and they were reviewing cause of death. It was a homeless individual, had been drinking alcohol, and of course, alcohol dilates everything, can make it easier for you to become dehydrated, and makes you more susceptible to heat-related illnesses. So all these things are important. The article does note alcohol and caffeine are two things that you need to be worried about because they contribute to dehydration and will make you more prone to heat-related illnesses. These are the kind of things that you should be on reviewing on a regular basis. And I just throw this article out there as a means to an end to remind you on different ways you can encourage yourself to study. And this is one of those ways, is looking at things you're expecting to see in the coming days, weeks, and months. Next up in the news, a look at healthcare reform. All right, wait for the groans. Oh, I don't want to hear about healthcare reform. I'm tired of hearing about healthcare reform. Well, I just want to throw this out there because this is a hot topic. And so, yeah, I know you've heard all about it, but let's look at it from another perspective. We in the medical community, the emergency medical community specifically, are really involved in healthcare issues on the front lines. We see things every day that point to the fact that our system in the United States here is just essentially broken. How broken is a matter of discussion. Whether it can be made better is also a matter of discussion, but that discussion is going on right now, and especially in areas of rural regions. There are 60 million Americans in rural parts of the United States that have real issues finding a primary source of health care, and so they often turn to 911 and the local emergency department as a resource. And we, of course, become impacted by that because emergency departments become overcrowded. And in rural areas, there aren't emergency departments just to divert to easily. You end up going an hour away to the next nearest emergency department, which ties up your unit and leaves your area uncovered for the next emergency. There's a lot of things we see in EMS that are affected by healthcare issues that may not be on the forefront of the minds of our legislators. And that's where I'm going with this. No matter how you feel about healthcare reform, you need to let your views be heard. Don't just assume that some organization is taking care of that for you. First of all, everybody will agree that EMS does not have any kind of unified voice when you compare our voice to the voice of an organization like the American Nurses Association, the voice of the firefighters, the voice of the American Medical Association. We are woefully underrepresented by a national consensus group or consensus body. And so we really struggle to get our voices heard. But the advantage to that is that individuals who call their elected officials, I think, are much more effective at getting change or getting their voice heard, because these folks in the staffs of our congressmen hear from lobbyists and special interest groups all the time, but they don't hear as often from individual members of their communities and constituency of their representative. And so if you can call in and contact them or send a letter or an email in stating your concerns specifically, you will get an answer. And you may not like the response you get, because they're going to say whether they agree or not agree with you, but they're going to give you an answer that gives you where their point of view stands. And you now have another point of contact to get back in touch with them and say, well, I'd like you to understand this is my viewpoint. So how do you do that? Easy. House.gov, Senate.gov. Contact those websites. You put in your state and your zip code, and they take care of the rest. They actually get you right to the links where you can use the contact page or the phone number to call into their office. I prefer using the phone because I like talking to the staffer in charge. Just call up and say, I'd like to speak to the staff member for Congressman so-and-so that's in charge of the healthcare reform issue. And introduce yourself, tell them what you do, and tell them that you want to make sure that they understand what your viewpoint is on this issue. Enough said, I just wanted to make sure that we are represented, and the best way to do that is for each and every one of you to be represented personally. Well, more on that story from Oklahoma on the paramedic trooper scuffle. I think we've talked about this a couple of different episodes here on the Medicast, and if you haven't seen the video, there's a link, and you can look at it on the link in the show notes for this news item. But the trooper himself was given a 5-day suspension based on his actions, which I think is probably a little lighter than I would have given. But the paramedic involved has sued the trooper for choking him. Now, you know, for a group of people that are in danger of being sued for frivolous lawsuits, I'd like to think that EMS providers are not as quick to fire the legal trigger, as it were, on something like this. And so this is kind of annoying to me, and I'll just put it in plain and simple terms. I don't understand why he's suing someone on this particular issue. And suing this particular trooper, I haven't checked recently, but I think troopers make only slightly more or about the same as paramedics and EMS providers do. So I don't know where he expects to get money out of this particular situation, but he's trying to squeeze a stone to get water. I don't think you're going to get anything. And all it's going to do is prolong the whole issue. My feeling is, this has been taken care of. I think the paramedic has been adequately represented and vindicated in the news, at least based on what everyone's seen. And I'd like to just see this issue go away. I think, you know, that the trooper's been reprimanded, maybe perhaps not strongly enough in some people's views, but at least this has come out on the side of troopers just can't stop paramedics in the line of duty transporting a patient and attempt to lock up people, paramedics who are just trying to handle patient care. And I think that's what this says, and I think it sets the standard for taking care of our patients and making sure that we can get our patients to the hospital and stepping in the line and saying, hey, you've got to let this proceed so we can get our patient into the hospital. Enough said, but I just wanted to point out that this seems to have come to a resolution, and I'd like to see this end right here. Finally, in the news, another story on the swine flu. That's right, the H1N1 virus is on the horizon again. Actually, it never left, and I think that that's just an indication that it doesn't generally cause severe effects in the patients. It's a somewhat mild version of the flu in its present form, because it can mutate easily, but it is particularly virulent. It is easy to spread. Transmission between people seems to be pretty easy and rapid. So it's a highly communicable disease, and so it's anticipated that it's going to really cause a little bit of havoc as we roll into the flu season here in the United States and North America this year. And so we're expecting to see the pandemic progress. The World Health Organization recently put out a report that said that they're still tracking swine flu across the globe and that it is still a problem, and they consider this pandemic to be in its early stages still. And again, a pandemic does not always mean that it's going to kill everybody. You know, we're not talking about the mass deaths that we've seen, but there is still a cost to having large numbers of individuals out sick for an extended period of time. And of course, it will be dangerous and possibly fatal to individuals at risk. And that includes our immune compromised, the very young, and the very old. And these people are going to be at increased risk for dying or extreme complications from this flu. And so you're going to have additional people tying up the healthcare system. You're going to have loss of wages and work time from a large number of workers who miss work because they're ill. The only way to stop the spread of this disease is to really progress and say, people, if you're sick, stay home, which here in the United States is not the way we do things. I think in other countries it's a little more lenient, but you're expected to go to work and tough it out if all you've got is a bad cold, which is what this is going to end up being for most healthy people. But of course, when you go into a workplace and you give it to 20 other people, they are likely to come in contact with somebody who fits the at-risk population, and that causes further problems. So one of the problems is, and this is an article off of EMSresponder.com, Canada is worried, and I think a lot of places are worried, about mass health worker absenteeism in the event of a larger scale pandemic. This is something that is a valid fear of any management team in the face of the pandemic for healthcare staffing. And I think it is going to be something we're going to have to deal with as well. Are you going to go into work if you know that there are so many sick people that you're just almost guaranteed to get a version of the swine flu, that even a vaccine may not be 100% effective at protecting you, and you still, even if you are protected, may carry the disease home to your family members? This is a problem. I know Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal podcast talks about this kind of thing a lot and says that one of the things that needs to be done when you plan for a pandemic like this and plan for doses of flu vaccine is that you allow for not just vaccines for your employees, but also vaccines for your employees' immediate family, so that they can feel safe going home at the end of the day, that their family members will also have reserved doses of the vaccine for them, so that they can feel safe coming to work. Okay. So something to think about and something to ask your supervisors or your training officers or your medical directors, have they worked something like this into the plan, and how are they expecting to handle some absenteeism issues during a proposed or prospective pandemic? This week's tip and trick of the week, we're going to be looking at CPAP. Continuous positive airway pressure is, for some of us, kind of one of those miracle devices. Those of us who remember the good old days, or I guess the bad old days, when we would have a patient who had problems with their COPD or their asthma or congestive heart failure, and we had no way to support their respiratory drive and depression because of their just exhaustion from trying to breathe and ventilate themselves. And we would have to intubate a conscious patient using nasotracheal intubation techniques and things like that. And CPAP has made that, at least in my area, largely a thing of the past. We still learn that skill, and we still need to have it available for some presentations of patients. But because we're now able to provide CPAP treatment to our patient, which is a non-invasive treatment for helping a patient assist their own ventilations by increasing the pressure and taking some of the load off of their tired respiratory muscles, we are able to take care of a lot of problems that we would not have been able to take care of otherwise. And so patients who would have really struggled and needed to be intubated, we don't have to do that anymore, thanks to CPAP. So let's talk a little bit about CPAP. First of all, I want to do a brief review of airway pressures and remind you of the physiology and the mechanics of how we breathe and how we ventilate ourselves. When you take a breath, it is an active thing. It is we use our muscles to contract and lift the rib cage away and contract our diaphragm to pull down, and we create a larger space in our chest cavity, which creates less pressure in the chest cavity in the thoracic area and draws air, essentially drawing air in, like you would suck air through a straw. The same thing happens in our lungs. We create a lower pressure area, and the atmospheric pressure pushes the air, like just like it's running through a tube, down into our lungs. When you have an obstruction or an obstructed airflow, either because of a chronic lung disease caused by years of smoking, airway burns, congestive heart failure, which has caused your lungs to fill up with fluid, or asthma, which is a constricting of the airways, all of these things make it harder for the patient to breathe. And over time, the respiratory muscles that they use for active breathing will become tired and unable to continue to force air in and out of the lungs. Or the lungs will fill up to the point that the vital air spaces, the areas of the lungs that contain the alveoli that transfer gases, are going to be full of fluid and unable to transfer gas effectively anymore. So that pressure inside the lungs, the residual pressure at the end of our exhalation, is the thing that determines how hard we work, really. It is the amount of air pressure we are able to have present at the end of a forced exhalation. Peak end tidal expiratory pressure is what we call that, PEEP or PEEP. And it's that PEEP level that is one of the things that determines the amount of work that we spend in breathing, the work of breathing. You might have heard that term before. Continuous positive airway pressure increases the pressure of the air going into the airways. Picture it like going down in a submarine, down below sea level, where there's an increased air pressure. And that increased air pressure makes it actually easier to breathe, because when you create a negative space in your chest, there's more pressure to push it in there. If you can increase the overall pressure of the system, in other words, the outside pressure, by putting a mask on them, increasing the pressure inside the mask, and the inside pressure, you can overcome what might have been a PEEP that was not allowing them to maintain inflated lung spaces, keep fluid out of the lungs, and things like that. So CPAP allows you to increase that airway pressure. So we needed to understand the mechanics of ventilation and understand that at the end of exhalation, we have that pressure that we need to overcome to maintain that end pressure that keeps our airspaces open. And if that pressure is unable to be effective anymore in keeping the lungs and passages open, then CPAP is going to increase that PEEP pressure, and that PEEP pressure increase will be enough to keep those passages open and keep the vital spaces open. And it does that by pushing open like you'd blow up a balloon, or by pushing fluid back into the vascular space. I mean, fluid's leaching into the lungs because of a left-sided heart failure. Remember, left-sided heart congestive heart failure from the left side of the heart, left side L, lungs L. The two L's go together, left side and lungs. So that is an indication that you have left-sided heart failure, and left ventricular failure will cause the fluid pressure to build up in the pulmonary space. And that fluid can't back up any farther than into the, you know, once it gets back into the right side of the heart. And so that back pressure actually forces the fluid, the plasma, out of through the capillary walls and into the only other place it can go, into the air spaces of the lungs. And when that happens, we get pulmonary edema. We get fluid in the lungs. By increasing the pressure of those air spaces, it is harder for the vascular diffusion of that fluid across the capillary walls. And if you couple that with the application of nitroglycerin and nitrates or other methods to decrease the blood pressure, you will quickly push that fluid back into the vascular system. So that's the goal of CPAP. So let's talk a little bit about specifically what we need to do for CPAP. Indications for CPAP in the EMS setting are most likely to be for patients who are experiencing respiratory distress or failure due to something like cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Also patients with COPD or asthma, where the patient is having problems with spontaneous respiration maintenance, and also they need to also have patent airway. You can't put CPAP on a patient who is unconscious and is not spontaneously breathing on their own, because the device itself is initiated by the ability to take a breath. In other words, that valve that keeps that pressure in place and lets the air flow into the patient is activated by the patient initiating a breath, and that sucking of the air, or the decrease of the pressure in the thoracic cavity, causes that pressure drop to open the valve and let the air flow in. It won't work if they're not breathing on their own. So we have a patient who has this problem. What kind of issues can we expect by applying CPAP? Well, it is a non-invasive procedure. It's not putting a tube on the patient, but patients can experience claustrophobia associated with the device. The mask can cause some patients to be afraid. It's a very tight-fitting mask. You have to have a secure seal, or you won't have a sealed environment for that pressure. You need to have the mask seal tightly to the face, and then you have this whole contraption in most of the cases that goes around the head with rubber clamps and, you know, straps and things that hold this onto the person's face. And there are many different devices and manufacturers that do this, but they all, you know, when you look at somebody with a CPAP mask on, you know, they look pretty frightening. And I can only imagine how they feel to the individual on the other side. You have some contraindications for the use of CPAP, and that's because you can cause additional problems if you have certain things present in these patients. If the patient has endotracheal intubation as a preferred version of securing the airway, in other words, they are not able to maintain a patent airway, we may need to go to ET tube application, and then we'll have to maintain a higher PEEP by way of bag valve mask. Also, there are situations where the patient may have problems associated with not responding well to the CPAP. Also, remember that by increasing the pressure in the thoracic cavity, we can cause hypotension. Remember that the heart itself relies on a negative pressure gradient in the chest cavity to help venous return to the heart, get back. And so if you increase the pressure of the airway system, you will increase the pressure inside the chest cavity, and consequently, you will increase the pressure on the venous side of the system, and it may not be as easy to draw venous blood back to the heart. So that's something to be aware of. You may see hypotension just from the application of CPAP. And of course, if you add in nitroglycerin or other nitrates to that, you could cause additional problems. You can cause, a patient with a pneumothorax should not get this. Obviously, if they have the presence of a pneumothorax and you increase pressure, you're just going to push more air through the hole in the lungs and into the chest cavity, also causing an increase in the pressure. And you're going to have to do a needle decompression to get that air out. You know, if you have to decrease the pressure in a CPAP system normally, you just take the CPAP off and pressure returns to normal. But if you have a pneumothorax and you make it worse, you're going to needle decompress these patients. So you don't want to apply it to patients with a pneumo. Patients with a head injury, again, because you're going to increase the thoracic pressure, that will also increase some pressure going up into the head. And the application of pressure in the upper airways also will cause increased pressure inside the skull and also increase intracranial pressure. So that can be a problem. Patients with a head or neck injury, because of the application of the mask and all the straps and things, can cause issues. Patients may not tolerate the mask because they're afraid of it or it makes them claustrophobic. And they have an increased risk of vomiting or aspiration because the increased pressure can also cause them to trap air down in their gastric path, in their esophagus, and down into their stomach. And if that happens, we are going to have patients who can have a much increased danger of some kind of reflux and of vomiting and aspiration. So they need to be monitored carefully if they are at risk for that. Patients with any kind of facial fractures and any kind of other issues associated with neck or facial injuries as well may be contraindicated. So we have patients that are going to be getting CPAP, and we are applying the device to these patients. We want to administer oxygen to these patients according to protocol, and most CPAP devices will allow you to administer oxygen. They use your oxygen tank to apply the pressure and run the device. The device actually runs on the oxygen pressure. So you're going to apply that to the patient, apply the device according to the manufacturer's settings, and then you're going to want to reassess your patients carefully. Some of the side effects of this device can include causing a pneumothorax, causing trauma to the pulmonary tissues, and possibly even causing a blowout, a pneumothorax to occur by increasing the pressures too high. So make sure you're using your device according to manufacturer's guidelines and understand how to adjust the PEEP level for patients accordingly. Again, be aware of hypotension being a problem. Also be aware of increased intracranial pressure. Patients should be conscious and alert and be able to at least respond to questions with a nod or something similar that you can communicate with them. Again, be aware of gastric distension. Patients should be able to sit upright. That'll help with the gastric distension and the reflux and bringing up of stomach contents. We don't want to lay patients flat if we have to put this on them. We need to have them sitting up to give them this particular device. Again, this may cause problems if it's on for an extended period of time with some kind of a pressure injury to the tissues of the face. So that could be something that happens. And you need to be aware that there are potential problems associated with application of CPAP to a patient. So this is just the review of CPAP and kind of exactly what we're looking for and what to expect. You're going to have, obviously, classes associated with your particular device and program, and, of course, always refer to your own protocols when you're looking at any kind of treatment or medication. You should be reviewing your protocols appropriately. But this is just to give you an overall understanding of CPAP, why we use CPAP, what it does, and also some of the things to watch out for your patient. As always, with any intervention, we need to reassess frequently and monitor our patients for changes in the way we apply the intervention or for discontinuance of the intervention if it is necessary. And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and remind you that everything we talk about, including links to additional information for things like the CPAP review, I've got links to a great slideshow that are in the show notes for that. So you can go and check that out online for additional information and the news items. All those links are available over in the show notes for this episode at medicast.com/blog. Those of you that get the newsletter from the Medicast, of course, get all the show notes and links sent to you directly by email. So if you want to sign up for the newsletter, go to medicast.com/blog, and you'll see the sign up for the newsletter right there at the top on the front page. Sign up, just need your name and email address, and we'll take care of the rest. You'll get an email sent to you to make sure that someone's not spamming you, and you can confirm that you want to belong to the newsletter, and then we'll take care of the rest. And you can get the show notes, links, and resources sent directly to you. If you have any comments, suggestions, corrections, anything like that, get them into me here so we can share them with the Medicast community. I also want to hear from you if you're having some kind of problem or need something. You know, we want to get your questions answered. And of course, news links are always welcome. Send those in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also check in with me here, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and I will be happy to return your emails promptly. I usually get back to folks within a day or so, and also I like to get back to you over on the voicemail line as well, so make sure you leave your email address there. Just a quick note, next week's Medicast will be put out a few days early. I'm going to be traveling that weekend and not be around Sunday night near my computer to upload and take care of everything. So that'll be going out Friday evening. And so you can get it early. Instead of looking for it on Monday morning, you'll actually have it there Friday evening for you to check out early if you'd like to. And I'll be checking in email sporadically throughout the rest of that week, but I may not be able to get right back to you. But send those emails in anyway. I will return your email. That's going to close it out for me here on the Medicast. I want to remind everybody to make sure that you check out the show notes, and we'll be closing out the show tonight with a song from a PodSafe music artist we've played here before. This is Matthew Ebel, E-B-E-L. Matthew Ebel is one of the artists we play here frequently. This is a song I don't think I've played for quite a while, though. It's Matthew's song, Drive Away. If you like what you hear, check out his music in the link in the show notes, and also make sure you let him know you heard it here on the Medicast. There's a link there also to purchase his songs over at iTunes if you'd like to do so, and I urge you to do so because that's a great way to support the artists that provide their music for podcasts like this one. So without further ado, Matthew's song coming up here, and I will close out and remind you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and hey folks, don't forget, scene safety, BSI.
There's a curve in the road so sharp it'll make you bleed. We don't talk, we just punch the clock. Can't find each other in the same old gridlock. Maybe a little escape, what we need. Living your love and your work like a dog every morning. The city's a pain like the latte stain on your dress. Get in the van before you break down. It don't cost. And I took it for granted. A bump in the road, not really a part of the drive. Come on, it's alright. You made me believe tonight. It's love that makes it so damn good to be alive. Oh, so let's drive. coffee shops and the bars.